What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
The most advanced computer on the planet is still the one in between your ears.
Even a small bit of brain smaller than a sesame seed has a billion connections in it. It's extraordinarily complex.
And that's just in the brains of mice. The brain's intricate neural code underlies who we are. It's the hub that controls our movements, actions, and perceptions. Neuroscientists want to solve this code in hopes of learning how brain activity translates to behavior and what's to blame when a disorder or a disease causes a problem.
The problem is computers don't understand brains. Brains don't understand computers. So we got to figure out what the dialogue is going to be there.
Thanks to advances in hardware and artificial intelligence, we're beginning to pull back the curtain on how the brain functions. Doing so might one day enable internet-connected brains, communicating with our thoughts, and better therapies for memory-robbing diseases such as Alzheimer's.
People have imagined this future where humans are augmented by machines, by artificial intelligence, and conversely, machines are augmented by human capabilities. So the machines benefit from what makes us human, and the humans benefit from what machines can do really, really well.
This episode, we meet the scientists trying to decode and potentially recode the human brain.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
Well, I was a salesman most of my life, and I had a bump on my arm. It wasn't bothering me or anything, so I didn't pay too much attention to it. And then my wife told me, she says, you need to have that looked at.
The bump on Johnny Matheny's arm was actually a really rare kind of cancer. He had two choices, lose his arm or lose his life.
And so here we go.
He got a basic prosthetic with a hook in place of his hand. Then he got an experimental robotic limb that looks like something out of a sci-fi film. It hooks up to what's left of his upper arm with a metal rod. His brain communicates with the arm through a band that's full of sensors. When Matheny thinks about moving it, his brain sends signals down to his upper arm. These are picked up by the sensors and then are translated into movement. It's one of the most advanced arms of its kind in the world, and Matheny is the only person to get to use it in daily life.
I don't have to worry about, can you come in here and help me? I need you to hold this. I need you to open this for me. I need you to do this for me. I can basically do everything on my own now. I'm in the kitchen now, doing the cooking that I want to cook, getting back out in the yard work. I mean, before, I like to garden.
Learning to use this new arm didn't come easy. At first, just moving it took a lot of work.
With this, you know, you had to think hard for every action that you want to do, like a hand close or a hand open or bend or flex the elbow. You couldn't just say, well, you know, I'd like to open my hand.
But his arm is not yet equipped with a sense of touch. Without looking at it, he can't sense its position nor how fast it's moving. The only sensation he feels is a vibration when the arm touches a surface.
I want to be able to feel, because 95% of everything you do with your hand is with sensory.
Matheny can't control the grip strength in his robotic hand. He also can't make hand gestures completely on his own. To do these things, he relies on a custom smartphone app, which allows him to pre-program specific gestures and adjust the strength of his grip.
This is the app. You can go through every movement that you want to be able to use in the arm. So what I do is I figure, today, what am I going to do? What grips do I need to incorporate in the hand?
If he's going to be interacting with people, he keeps it light. He doesn't want to accidentally squeeze someone's hand too hard.
It takes about 30 seconds to incorporate the grip, put the phone away, and go on, start doing my stuff.
His arm was developed outside Baltimore, Maryland, by engineers and neuroscientists at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab. And they're working on updates.
I'm Bruce Sweat. I'm a computational and experimental neuroscientist. Now, one of the challenges that you have, because it has so many joints and degrees of freedom, it's very hard to control. So we've been working on novel forms of brain-computer interfaces.
Such interfaces are typically implanted during brain surgery, but they want to avoid that if possible. So they're working on non-invasive ways to put the right signals back into the brain.
And that's really what you need for Johnny. We can do basically sensors on the skin so that he could feel it in a different part of his body. Now, he could map that over time, but that's kind of a stopgap. What we'd really like is for him to feel that as a perception, just like he would any other limb.
That requires a more intimate connection between the arm and Matheny's brain. The sensors that control his arm can detect brain signals, but they can't send messages back. And it's in the brain that sensations like touch are created.
If we're interested in knowing what makes us human, what we do, what our preferences are, we want to study the brain. I'm Daniela Hernandez. I'm the digital science editor for The Wall Street Journal, and I cover robotics, AI, and neuroscience. Before joining the journal, I was a neuroscientist myself. Some neuroscientists compare studying the brain to studying the universe. And we are just at the very, very beginning of understanding the known universe. It's very similar when it comes to the brain. We know a lot, but in some ways we know very, very, very little. And I think what we'll discover, as we are also discovering when we go out beyond our own planet, is that the more we discover, the more mysteries that we'll encounter, and the more and better tools we'll need to develop to get us further.
The problem is computers don't understand brains. Brains don't understand computers. So we got to figure out what the dialogue is going to be there. My name is Justin Sanchez, and I'm the director of the Biological Technologies Office at DARPA.
DARPA is part of the Defense Department, and it funds emerging technologies like Matheny's arm. The agency is also developing ways to connect brains and computers. These are being tested to help paraplegics move robotic arms with their thoughts. At first, these systems could only interface with about 100 of the brain's billions of neurons.
Back then, it was like 100 was doing really, really well. No, that was partly limited to just the sensors that we're using, but it was also the speed of the computers.
Because the brain is electric, scientists use electrodes to study its activity. Now, thanks in part to better and smaller electrodes, scientists can record thousands of neurons. But this is still a drop in the bucket.
And just to give you a reference for how tightly packed the neurons are, there's about 100,000 neurons per cubic millimeter. We're having this conversation on the fly here. Our neurons are firing like crazy, and that pattern of firing is relating to everything that we're doing here. Every millisecond, there's some unique pattern of that activity. And how does that correspond to your state? Are you trying to do something? Are you trying to recall a specific memory? Are you depressed? Do you have anxiety? I mean, that code is really what underlies all of that.
And there's no one-size-fits-all model for decoding these neural patterns.
The brain does not stay constant. The environments that we work in do not stay constant.
That's why scientists and engineers are working on better software to analyze all that data, as well as new kinds of brain probes.
And then on top of all this micro-machined electrical interfaces, there's new optical technologies that can sense optical signals from the brain or even magnetic signals from the brain. And, you know, when you put all of those together in unique combinations, you open up the door for interfacing with the brain in entirely new ways.
Still, these tools don't give scientists all the details they need to understand the brain because they don't directly interact with the brain's neurons. The information is valuable, but limited. It's like getting a satellite image when what you want is street view.
You know, you don't send your car to get fixed by the dentist because they don't know what the parts are and how they work together. There's a huge body of knowledge about the brain, but certainly, despite that body of knowledge, our understanding of the brain or our ability to cure diseases can use a lot of improvement. My name's Tim Jarski. We're at the Allen Institute for Brain Science.
The Institute was started by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. Jarski's team is using machine learning to help identify connections between neurons in slivers of brain tissue from mice, also from humans who donate pieces of their brains after surgery. But brain tissue from humans can only last a few days, and samples from mice, only a few hours. Scientists keep these samples alive by dousing them in artificial cerebrospinal fluid, heating the solution to body temperature and bubbling it to maintain a flow of oxygen. Then they record from brain tissue using small needles that measure the electrical signals of neurons. It's like using tiny microphones to listen in on how brain cells communicate. During a recent visit, scientists were experimenting on samples from mice.
You know, we're actively sort of talking to the cells, right? And what we're doing is we want to know if one's connected to the other. So what we do is we activate one cell and do nothing to the other cells except record them.
That means if they get one cell to send a message and they see a response in its neighbor, there's a connection between them. Those connections are where the brain encodes information, and they change over time as an animal learns. Understanding their dynamics is crucial for understanding the brain. And once they get this data, they need to analyze it.
So it was a huge effort, right, just to, like, get the data. But what you don't see is all the effort that goes into processing the data. And so that involves a huge amount of both neuroscience expertise and computational expertise, but that's what we spend the majority of our time, and that's scientifically the most interesting thing that we do.
Researchers also need to know how local connections relate to what other parts of the brain are doing. For that, they need tools that look at the brain's activity patterns more broadly. For ethical reasons, that's easier to do in animals. This is a recording of mouse brain taken by Jarski's colleagues with an implantable probe called NeuroPixels. It sounds like static, but hidden in the noise could be insights about brain function. Each needle-like probe can record the activity of hundreds of neurons across multiple areas of a living brain. With several probes, researchers can record thousands. Outside Washington, D.C., researchers at the Genelia Research Campus are doing just that. The facility focuses on high-tech neuroscience.
People have tried to make statements about how the brain works by recording, you know, a handful of neurons at a time, maybe 100. Now, if you, like, think about what small percentage of the brain that is, right, like 1% of a 1% of a 1%, now how can you make any judgments or inferences about a system when you're observing the tiniest amount of what it does?
That's Marius Pachizzario, a mathematician by training. His lab at Genelia developed software to find meaning in brain recordings.
There's an experiment going on right now. This is brain.
His lab also studies the visual cortex, the part of the brain that's responsible for sight. They're trying to understand how this region processes information as an animal moves and reacts to its environment. In their lab, behind a blackout curtain, a mouse is running on a ball in total darkness. The scientists see it on a computer monitor with the help of infrared cameras.
The mouse doesn't see us, doesn't see anything, actually. Complete darkness, no stimulus, no nothing, no sounds. The mouse is just running there, doing its thing.
To get a peek at the rodent's neurons as it's moving around, the lab is using fluorescent molecules to visualize thousands of neurons across the visual cortex at the same time. On a computer screen, a scientist monitors their activity as they flicker on and off, like dynamic constellations of stars.
And if you look carefully, these little round things are the cells. And if you look carefully, they kind of come and go. They activate, and then they kind of go back dim.
That's surprising because there's nothing for the mouse to see. So in theory, these cells shouldn't be active.
It turns out that a lot of their activity is related to what this mouse is doing at any one time.
In other words, neurons in an area of the brain thought to be important for vision also respond to movement. The finding suggests that the brain may be even more complicated than we thought. For some, the long-term hope is that unraveling its mysteries will lead to a future where brains and machines are more connected. Again, Justin Sanchez of DARPA.
Our vision of the future is like this new wave of computational systems that can learn from the brain and incorporate properties of the brain at the same time, understand how the machine is doing the processing and computation and improve how the brain is responding to all that. I think it's tightly coupled and goes hand in hand.
And this brings up ethical concerns.
Some scientists also worry that manipulating or probing the brain in certain ways can open up a lot of ethical questions that we are not ready as a society to really, really tackle. People are worried that as companies try to develop interfaces into the brain, that this will open up a lot of questions regarding privacy and ownership over our thoughts and even perhaps our identity. There's already been some research showing that when patients start to control robotic limbs, that they think of them as their own. They don't think of them as an external tool.
Same for patients getting neural stimulation to treat disorders like depression.
And so sometimes people will think, did I do that? Or was it an effect of the stimulation? And that really brings up a lot of questions about agency that people are just beginning to think about.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Anthony Green and Daniela Hernandez, with help from Brian Gutierrez. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong from The Newsroom in New York.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost-effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.